Hi everyone, and welcome to the Rexilon podcast. I'm Kirby Lachrunji.
And I'm Dawn Riddler. Every week we bring you the highlights, lowlights, and musings around the global econo-political environment that we feel might impact on your wealth.
Week number 12, and lots of topics to chat about this week. Again, we are talking Apple, Hermes, we are talking about tokenization and what that potentially could mean for the financial world, the Marco Polo think tank, and then we're going to be touching a little bit on TikTok again and what is happening in the United States as far as their ban of this is concerned. Just markets quickly, S&P 500 for the month now is up almost 4%, for the week up 0.26%. NASDAQ, though, down for the week by about 7 basis points, so basically flat on the week. For the rolling month, that's up 3.76%. You'll see the Dow Jones in the newsletter. That for the month is up 1.29%, for the week up 0.17%. Eurostoxx 50, flat for the week, but for the month up 4.69%. For the year now, and that's a rolling year, the Eurostoxx 50 is up almost 20%. Not so bad for a continent that most people would think has been in decline. And then if we head across into Asia, Nikkei 225, that's up 3.38% for the week. If one looks at the rolling year, the Nikkei is up 19.54%. Remember, this exchange for many years has been in the doldrums, but because we're now starting to see a normalization of the bond market, there's some life that gets poured into this exchange. Across in China, Shanghai up 1.18%. And then just currencies, Rand dollar 19.03, the euro against the Rand 20.56, against the pound 23.96. Bitcoin now at $64,000 per Bitcoin. Dawn, interesting week again. South Africa stays in the doldrums. We don't see a vast amount of returns from the South African market at the moment. As a matter of fact, on the rolling 12-month period, the all share is down 1.93%. That has partly got to do with the fact that we're very commodity-focused, the exchange at this stage. And because it's so commodity-focused, most commodity companies are just under pressure at this stage. We've seen these kind of blockbuster numbers coming out of commodities post the Ukraine issue or during the Ukrainian issue. And we've just seen kind of that this is just the after effect of all of that happening. So the action really is on Wall Street and in the United States. And that is basically where the action stops at this stage.
Yes. And Kobe, as we both know, it's still all AI stocks. It doesn't seem to want to stop. Those magnificent seven are just carrying on, albeit at perhaps a little bit of a slower pace. But there's a lot of news in our newsletter. We've talked quite extensively also about AI. I think it's quite important because it's become such a huge factor in the markets to actually start to understand how AI is going to be used going forward. The futurization. Mm. I mean, a lot in the newsletter is actually futurization because you also talk about tokenization, which is another aspect of what we're going to be seeing going into the future. But AI is really quite interesting. And in the piece that I wrote in the newsletter this week, I actually picked up some research that came out of the Marco Polo Institute over in the US that has been looking at the people side of it, the engineers, the analysts that are behind AI. And it's quite concerning in many ways that over 50% of those AI researchers, as they call them in the paper, are coming out of China. And only about 18% of them are actually coming out of the US. You know, Canada in Europe is also heavily involved in AI and in the UK, but only 18% to China's 50% is actually coming out of the US. And of that 18%, over 40% are actually Chinese nationals that have come over into the US, do their master's and their PhD over in the US. And that is all obviously concerning because the US is not taking that threat, in my opinion, seriously enough. I think you can see in Congress that the real threat of it is starting to filter through. They think the threat is TikTok. The threat is clearly not TikTok. The threat is the weaponization of AI, which is where the biggest application of AI, which remains unsaid, is happening, is the use in the military, side of things. It's an evolving field, and unfortunately, the regulations are just not keeping up with the technology. And by the time the regulations have kept up with the technology, I rather fear that we're going to be left behind. The West is going to be left behind.
Yeah, Dawn, I was sitting listening to some podcasts around, chip manufacturers and just generally, and the focus I think was on NVIDIA and what the new chips are actually doing. Gone are the days where chip manufacturers are now just manufacturing chips. They go into hardware, and then there's a life cycle for that chip, and then there's a new chip that gets developed, and there's a new one that gets launched, and this is where the competition is. That life cycle has become much shorter. And the application of these chips have become very industrial. So if you look at like where NVIDIA chips go into, yes, you could certainly get NVIDIA in your laptop, but the big applications are in data centers, machines that are learning from an artificial intelligence perspective how the world is working and how to apply in a normal bell curve type scenario. What are the answers that need to be given? That is on a steamroller of absolute note at this stage. And this is what I think a lot of the investment community is battling to price at this stage. You're right. TikTok is a sideshow. That's what's happening in the United States. I mean, you make the point in the latest newsletter that India actually banned TikTok because of their long-lasting with China. The Americans could do the same thing, obviously, but when India banned TikTok, almost 200 million users fell off the TikTok user base, and they just ended up going onto Facebook's Reels and Instagram in order to make up for that. There are alternatives. It's not like there's no alternative to TikTok. It's not like this is an antitrust type legislation there where you're going to be changing the face of a product, so to speak. There are alternatives, and certainly India has proven that you could potentially utilize those alternatives. When you come back to artificial intelligence, it's a pity the world can't work together. We've got these factions that are kind of sitting and staring at each other across the oceans. And then in the midst, you've got people trying to develop technology. And those technologies are driven by individuals. Those individuals reside in countries. And I wonder if at some point people don't kind of sit up and say, well, you know what? Actually, I don't want to be. I'm not going to be a citizen of a country. I don't want to be domiciled somewhere. I'm going to be domiciled in the web somewhere. I'm going to be selling my service into the web rather than trying to domicile myself somewhere. Because perhaps people that are into this kind of research stuff is really there for the research more so than for trying to build a national identity or trying to be part of a flag.
I think Bitcoin is a case in point, because
Good
nobody, in
example.
fact, at this point in time, actually really knows with any kind of definity who the founder of Bitcoin was. Obviously, when you start talking about, being non-citizens, all I can think about is, sovereign citizens out of the US. Yeah, they're sovereign citizens until they go out and vote for Trump. So, it's yeah it it's we in a fastly evolving world, but and it, I just find it all really interesting, especially the clash of cultures that you're seeing, because remember Xi is actually trying to take everybody back to Mao Zedong. You're trying to take everybody back a century. And then you've got the US, and especially if you talk about the left on the US, which has gone, so woke that you don't know whether you're Arthur or Mary at the end of the day, and you have to get all particular about what pronouns you use and things. I mean, the different cultures, I mean, they're getting further apart. They're not getting closer together,
Correct.
but it's very interesting. And I mean, which probably brings us into the next story, where we're talking about antitrust. A couple of Hermes consumers in California have decided that the way that Hermes sells their, particularly their Birkins, but their Birkins and their Kelly bags, is unfair, right? And so they've now bought an anti-competitive antitrust suit against Hermes in the States, which makes me laugh.
What does a Birkin cost, Dawn? If you had to buy a Birkin bag, how much is that?
Well, if you could, they're about $60,000,
Okay,
right?
right.
On the resale market, they're as high as $400,000.
Oh yeah,
right?
sure. The primary product, you've got to stand in line, right?
Yeah.
You've got to be part of the
Yeah.
waiting list. Yeah. Yeah.
They're about a Kelly you can probably get for about $20,000, but
Yeah.
all of them brand new, and this is what they're bitching about at the end of the day, is that they can't walk into an Hermes store and buy a Kelly in the color of their choice, etc. Right?
Sure.
You have to
Yeah.
quite literally suck up to the sales associates, as they call themselves, and buy the odd bits and pieces. You know, the amount of ancillary sales, or tied sales, as it's called in the industry, that you have to make to get offered a Birkin is about $60,000 before
Sure.
you can buy one for another $60,000. Right? So, I mean, listen.
Scarcity is the business model here. I
Yes.
mean, you make it scarce, you make it difficult to obtain in the primary market, you drive up the price in the secondary market for secondary bags and for secondary
Yeah.
goods, and you just continue just to make sure that your primary market continues to be as exclusive as you possibly can. That's the business model. And as you continue to do this, you continue to drive profitability. I mean, Hermes is a brilliant company. It's and I mean, in its years that it's been a publicly listed company, it's been a brilliant company. But certainly before that, the founders spent hard yards trying to build the exclusivity around the brand and exclusivity around the handbags and so forth and so forth. It's no different to other luxury brands. They do the same thing.
Rolex,
You know,
for
you
example.
want. Yeah, absolutely. You want one? It's not a problem. Go introduce yourself to an authorized dealer, build a relationship, and go on a waiting list. And that can be a long time. It's up to an authorized dealer to provide one to you, should you wish to own one. It's no different with Hermes. As a matter of fact, it's no different with Patek Philippe as it is with any other product. If you want another luxury brand, you can just walk in and get it. Well, suddenly it's not that attractive anymore, potentially, to own something like that. So I don't know if they win their court case, because ultimately Hermes can say, look, it's our business, you know how we do this. And
Absolutely.
look, let's face it, they can shut all the American stores tomorrow and just operate out of Europe, and people will fly to Europe to go and buy these things. You don't have to be in the United States to do this kind of thing. People will fly to Europe to go do it. They can deliver in the Europe in the US, quite frankly.
You know, the thing is that all Hermes they would then have to do is say, okay, a Birkin is no longer 60,000, it's 120,000.
Exactly. And what are you going to do then? Are you going to
Yeah,
say
so
no? There
you
are
bitten
people
off
that'll
your nose
pay
to
for
spite your
that.
face, right?
I listened to a very interesting talk on how Hermes actually goes about sourcing their product, the raw materials to go into the bags and all of these things. And I mean, it is a proper system. They've been doing business with people that source their leathers for decades. We're not talking about rocking up and getting a guy to supply you with leather and you're going to hope for the best. There's a specific type, there's a specific color, there's a specific texture, there's a specific quality, there's all these things that are required, the stitching. I mean, there's a vast amount of work that goes into making one of these, and arguably the profit margins are huge, Dawn. There's no doubt. There's no
There's no
doubt that
doubt.
Hermes makes a lot of money.
I think one of the things you need to understand about their Birkins and Kellys and all of their bags is that they're handmade, right?
Correct.
They're hand stitched, and you know
Correct.
each Birkin has on average about 100, at least 100 hours of physical labor put into that. The fixtures and
Sure.
fittings are either 18 karat gold or palladium. Some of the higher end ones encrusted with diamonds. They use crocodile skin. I mean, they use a wide variety of different level leathers that have to be at the absolute highest quality. I
Yeah.
follow a reseller on TikTok. You know, sometimes they can only get a color in a certain leather in a certain color, and so there's a very small run of it. So it's a rare thing. And funny enough, if you own a Birkin, you know an Hermes Birkin, you know whether it's rare or not, because where it's printed Hermes just above the clasp, if it has a horseshoe, then it's of a rarer Hermes than the ordinary one.
Oh, right.
Oh, there you
Right.
go.
Yeah, there we
Go
go.
and check your wife's vast Hermes collection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dawn, one of the things that I wrote about this week is the whole world around tokenization. So if one looks at Bitcoin and one looks at any of the cryptocurrencies, they rely on a technology called blockchain in order to deliver them across the world, different owners in different jurisdictions. And the technology behind it is really something that is used in cryptocurrencies at the moment, but they're becoming more widespread, and the use of them is becoming more widespread. With that is the whole concept of tokenization. Now, tokenization, Dawn, is where we take any assets and we make it digital. So we break it up into pieces. So if you own a real estate investment trust, by the way, and you own units in a real estate investment trust, that's a form of tokenization. The real estate investment trust has taken a whole bunch of properties, put them together, and sliced and diced them into thousands of little units, and you can buy one of those units. That's a form of tokenization. But the one area where tokenization is not evident at this stage is when a client opens up an investment account. So you might have an investment account with a management company or with a linked investment service provider, or with an international custodian and a local custodian. All of those account numbers are unique, and they are unique to you, and it requires a separate FICA process for every single one of those that you go through. But the world is evolving, and potentially in the future, you might find that you will have one account, and that one account is originated potentially by an international organization, which takes the onus away from the intermediary having to open up your account. And that one account is able then to own a whole range of different assets. Now, if one can get that right, then all of a sudden, the first thing that a lot of people would say to me is, well, I don't want everybody to know what I own. And I want to say to them that they already do know. The
Tough.
automatic exchange of information basically allows tax authorities to see whatever they want to see across the world when they want to see that information. So people are in any case seeing this information. But what it will do is it will drive down the overall cost and complication of transactions across the world. Gone are going to be the days where you have to transfer money from one jurisdiction to another one through the SWIFT system, for instance, because you're going to have one account owning digital assets across different spectrums and in different places. And you could potentially opt in to buy a share or to buy an asset off a different exchange because it's just cheaper to do so. And suddenly you find that there's almost a reduction in cost just because of tokenization. Now, the technology exists. The only thing that doesn't exist at this stage is governments and the willpower to create this. But at some point, somebody is going to start creating something like this. And the question is, how does a South Africa fit into something like that? Gone will be exchange controls, for instance. If you're as a country continue to adhere to exchange controls and you continue to adhere to archaic systems of trying to implement these things, you might just be left behind. Your citizens might just opt to own their assets outside of your jurisdiction, and you're just going to find that you're starved of capital. And the question to me always is, I wonder how much the JSE is thinking about these things. We've had an absolute a ton of delistings happening across the JSE over quite a number of years. And I wonder how the JSE is going to cope with something like this. Have they got the money? Have they got the ability to be able to implement something like this to continue to stay relevant in Africa, from that perspective? That's kind of my glimpse to the future, Dawn. I think perhaps our lives might potentially look like something like that in the future.
And Kobe, I think it also comes to, what percentage of offshore portfolios to put into local investments. Because as the JSE shrinks and as it bumbles along, and I mean, it's shrinking, but nobody else in Africa has got a stock exchange even remotely the size of ours, right?
Yeah,
The
correct.
really big companies in South Africa also listed offshore, if you wanted
Yeah,
exposure to
correct.
them. Part of this sort of continuum and going into the future, I think the sort of the compulsory, 45% at the moment that has to go into, for example, a retirement annuity, I think that could change because, obviously you've got to deal
Correct.
with the volatility of the rand. But if, for example, we could use, and I'm just sort of talking off the top of my head at this point, is use South African bonds where we can get the decent yields that we want, the corporate bonds and things like that, where we can get yields of around about, say, 9, 9.5% or whatever. Whereas in an offshore bond, we're lucky to maybe get sort of 4. But on the growth side, to actually use mostly offshore. But then there's the problem of the volatility of the rand. So maybe one of the things that down the line is that currencies start to become more global. There's almost like a global currency, right? Like a sort of dollarization of the rand in many respects, so that you don't have this volatility. I know country pride and everything else is all tied up in this, but when you start looking down the line into the future, or maybe even the rimby or something, it's just when you get these little sort of tin pot currencies that sort of just keep on depreciating down into the ground, maybe getting some sort of solidity in there, and sort of then it becomes easier to sort of balance the books and interest rates can stabilize. You know, I think we live in interesting times, and as you say, the time scales for all of these things are just getting shorter and shorter.
It'll be something like the AUOI type legislations that came in post the 2008 financial crisis. And basically, there was an international organization. P countries joined, the large ones joined, they set the agenda. And then they said to countries across the world, look, you have a choice. You can either join, and then, we'll make sure that you are part of a system of international flows of capital. You'll get a tick mark. You won't get grey listed or blacklisted. And then we're all going to share information, and it's a lot free and open, and we can all see what our different citizens in our countries own and what they do. And you as a tax jurisdiction, you can levy the tax that you feel is appropriate. Now, AOI took quite a few years to try and get implemented, but you had a choice as a country. You could either join or you didn't have to join. You didn't join, well, there were ramifications for it. In the same way, if there's a global system, as every company in the world has an ISIN number, if you and I and or any other investor in the world has a global number, and you as a country could then adhere to that, and you could say, well, fine, I'm happy for my citizens in my country to have a global investor number. And that investor number could own a whole range of assets, and it could be domiciled wherever the client wishes to or the investor wishes to domicile the stuff. And all of a sudden, this drives down the cost of so on. Now, certainly, the ability for a country to utilize the capital of the citizens in their country almost as their own piggy bank, such as, listen, you may only invest your pension money in the following way. You have to buy these kind of bonds. You have to do this. You have to do that. All of a sudden, all of that falls away. Now, if you want to do that as a country, you're welcome to do so. But certainly, you're not going to be part of the global capital pool. You no longer have to become attractive because that's really how you attract capital, is that you stand on the world stage and you become an attractive destination. And countries should welcome this kind of thing. It'll keep them honest, and it'll keep them on their toes. And quite frankly, it'll mean a lot from a capital perspective, in the future. So I think tokenization will happen. Countries that are on the back foot will probably fight it for a while and then realize, listen, I have no choice, because if I have continued to fight this, global investors are never going to pour money into my companies or pour money into the exchanges or buy my bonds or any of these kind of things,
Talking about honesty, I think as a sort of full stop end of sentence for this week's pod, I think we can thank a certain somebody who lives down in Stellenbosch for taking out the trash. The trash is a good way of taking it out itself. The end of a saga.
What a story, hey Dawn. What a
What a
story, hey.
story.
Who would have thought? Who would have thought? But it's very sad, actually, ultimately,
Very sad.
because
Thousands of people have lost millions and millions of
a lot of
rand.
money. And
That's
ultimately for what? For
yeah,
what?
exactly.
Was it greed? Probably, probably. Fame? I'm not entirely certain. But that's why the human psyche will always boggle, I suppose.
Yeah, but I mean, look, it's what, nearly 10 years after the fact, I suppose. But obviously, the walls are falling in. And the writing was on the wall, and the Germans wanted to lock him up, and they were just, so it was all a little bit too much.
Yeah, absolutely. With that, we're going to end this week's podcast. Well, that's all for the week, folks. This podcast is based on our weekly free newsletter, which you can subscribe to at rexalom.co.za.
All our blogs and newsletters are also available on rexalom.co.za or wealthecology.co.za, and we welcome any suggestions for future topics. Thank you for lending us your ears.